Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, the well-being of children. So many of us have watched in horror as kids were separated from their parents at the border. The outrage seems to have brought about an end to the policy, but so many questions about what happens next remain. On the show this week, children struggling in a very different way. Psychologist Joanna Breyer worked for more than 25 years with young cancer patients and their families at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. She shares what she's learned about how families can cope in her new book titled When Your Child Is Sick. You must have one of the hardest jobs there is, that is, dealing with sick children. Tell us how you decided that that was the field you wanted to pursue.
It was not an avocation. In fact, I was rather nervous about it. I'd finished my postdoctoral internship at Cambridge Hospital working on a pediatric ward. I was intending to go away for the summer. I saw an advertisement for a child psychologist working with children with cancer and their families. And I thought, I'm not too sure I could do that, but maybe it would be a good experience to go and have an interview. So I went and had an interview. And then to my amazement and terror, I got a call through in the summer offering me the job. And I thought then, well, I suppose I can try it. I can always leave. And I actually didn't leave till 30 years later.
What was that first experience like? Do you recall?
It was nerve-wracking. Seeing sick children is awfully hard. On the other hand, children are incredibly resilient. They also have great senses of humor, and they're able to have fun, even in the hospital, sometimes, not always. But
yeah.
So I very quickly experienced that there were many different ways of being in the hospital, and that there were also ways that a child could suffer less being there.
So how did you make your way early on? How did you find your place and figure out what you could do to help those children?
It was a process, both working with families and working with medical staff. Sometimes I made mistakes, sometimes I misjudged what would appeal to a child, or at least would appeal to the parent, because the parent was always the gatekeeper appropriately for the child.
Of course.
And if I was over-focusing on the child, I might bypass the parent. And I think that took me a while to understand.
And what about working with the doctors themselves?
I learned the necessity of being tactful.
I'm sure.
And that if I felt that a doctor was either being insensitive or misguided, that there were ways of saying that or suggesting alternative ways to do things or a way that a child could be treated that would allow her to respond in a more cooperative way.
You know, it's so interesting when I think back on raising my own two children. And at one point when my son was very, very little, he was chewing on a carrot. And he started coughing. And then he stopped coughing. Seemed to be okay. But then I sort of noticed something strange in his breathing. And I put my ear to his mouth so that I could hear very carefully. and it didn't sound right to me. So he was my first child. I was a nervous mother. I called the pediatrician. He said, bring him to the hospital. I can remember my husband and I watching that little boy being taken away on a gurney. He turned back and waved to us. I'll never forget that picture. They had to go in to his lungs. Obviously, I stayed there night after night, but the fear that you must deal with when you see not only the child, a very sick child, but the parent as well, has to be such a challenge to you.
You're absolutely right. And parents, particularly to begin with, even however competent parents they are, it's still a new world that they're entering.
Absolutely.
And it takes a while to get your bearings in a completely new world where these things, which are routine precautions for the medical team to take, are not perceived by you as the parent as indicating that the worst is going to happen. And particularly if a child is diagnosed with cancer, where the fear always, almost always is that the child is going to die.
Oh, my.
Even though the statistics now are astoundingly good in terms of what they used to be, and that, you know, 80 to 90%, and in some instances, in some diagnoses, over 95% of the children are likely to get through their treatment successfully and live. But it takes a while for a parent to begin to believe those statistics. And, you know, you still worry whether you're going to be one of the few that where your child does not make it.
And when parents find out that their child is really desperately ill, how do you talk with them? And how do you explain to them that the child may not live?
That would be a rare conversation to have at the beginning of a child's treatment.
Because of course.
Now it's the day one talk, which is sort of like a medical team meeting that our hospital used to have, where all members of the medical team would be present and would go through what the plans were, what the treatment was, etc., and would be very much stressing the likelihood of a positive outcome. So that's a very different situation from when down the road a child may have relapsed. But still, now there are so many different types of treatment that a child can go through that still the conversation might be focusing on hopes that the child will be cured and what the necessary steps that the child, sometimes pretty tough ones.
Of course, you begin the book in a very practical way, talking about the hospital, a place where none of us hopes we will ever have to be with our child, but describe what importance it is to outline that in your book.
I thought it was important to help orient parents to what they would be facing. And when, you know, every morning six people arrive in their room, that they would quickly get an idea of who those people perhaps were and why they were there. And also to hopefully give some hints about how they can prepare themselves to get the information that they want and need, be it recording the conversation at a meeting, be it making a list beforehand of the questions that you want to ask. I mean, all practical things that just allow a parent to feel not exactly in control, but more that she really can get her questions asked.
At the same time, moving into that world. The hospital in and of itself can be terribly intimidating, and one may simply feel, how can I best protect my child, rather than what questions can I ask? And too often, I think even among adults, we see that there are not enough questions asked, that someone else, an advocate for the parent as well as the child, may be needed.
Sometimes I think that's the role that the social worker or the psychologist can play on a medical team, which is to be sort of an intermediary. I mean, A, to check with the parents that they are getting the information that they want and need, but that B, that it is being presented by the medical staff, nurses or doctors, in a way that the parent can take in, and that just sort of checking that everybody's understanding.
Yes,
everybody else.
Exactly. Tell me what else you see as your responsibility in that role.
Seeing that the parents have the opportunity to talk about what's going on, if that is what they want to do. Some parents do and some parents don't. Checking with them what is being hard, what is being particularly challenging for that family. Are the situations at home that they're trying to handle that the medical staff doesn't have any idea about? Or, you know, how are the other siblings in the family doing, which are a huge, you know, group, very hard hit by what's happening. And understandably, the parents are using up all of their energy, focusing on trying to understand what's happening with their child who's sick. And somehow or other juggling, you know, their jobs, who's taking care
exactly.
of getting an emergency help. So all of that is going on. And sometimes there may be unusual circumstances at home which require a parent actually to be at home rather more than the hospital staff assumes they should be when all of this is going on with their child. So it's sort of doing a thorough background conversation to understand the particular stresses on that particular family.
Now, a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Joanna Breyer.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. We'll continue talking with Joanna Breyer in a second, but first, we asked our audience if they had any personal experiences to share about navigating a child's illness. This message from Jack in Washington really moved me.
I just wanted to let you guys know that when she was 10 years old, my daughter had a massive stroke and was inpatient and in out of the ICU. I guess over a year, she had 18 various brain surgeries and procedures. We almost lost her 3 or 4 times. For any parent who has to go through that, my counsel is that they need to keep track of everything going on with their child and be their advocate. I mean, her neurosurgeon, who was really good, told us this at the beginning, that we needed to stay on top of everything for them, even though they were going to do the best they could. And I can also say that you don't know how this is going to impact you. I have my MBA in international finance, and I found that throughout the middle of the whole process, I found myself unable to do simple arithmetic. It really impacts you. And also, the other thing is, Don't be afraid to accept help from your friends and neighbors. You're going to need it. So anyway, that's kind of my input. Fortunately, my daughter has finally recovered mostly, and in fact, she's in college now, so it has a happy ending. But it was a rough time for us.
Now, the rest of my conversation with Joanna Breyer. You have written this book to help parents understand what they're going to face, how they're going to have to deal with that hospital situation, how they're going to deal with doctors. What else did you want to make sure through writing this book that parents understood?
I think a few things. One, that there are some very simple interventions that can help particularly young children cooperate with treatment, deal with anger, you know, become a little bit less afraid. And it depends on the child, because children, even though there are developmental similarities, there are also huge differences between children. And some find being in the hospital particularly difficult and dealing and cooperating with treatment. And they fight and they resist and they, all sorts of things. So one of the things that I saw my job is trying to figure out how to get the cooperation, to understand what was making it so difficult for this particular child.
Give me an example of how you would respond in a situation like that.
I would come in, introduce myself as a doctor, but a doctor who played and talked to children. And I would probably come along with some toys. And we would sort of take it from there. With a younger child, I would often come in with a puppet, because children are wonderfully able to respond to puppets in a way that they often don't respond to adults asking them questions. And I'd had the benefit of having a wonderful puppeteer, who is also a psychologist, working in our group and sort of giving us hints about how to use puppets. And so though I'm a terrible ventriloquist, it sort of didn't matter to the child. So I had a monkey that I used a lot, and he became quite real to some children.
Huh.
And he would develop some of the same problems that the child had. Whatever the child was not liking doing, the puppet would also tend to not be liking to doing it. And so we would work out ways together that the puppet could be helped getting through these things that were so difficult.
I see.
And then at one point, the puppet suggested, you know, well, wouldn't it be great if this worked for Susie too? And at this particular moment, the issue was taking medication. So we'd had, you know, the puppet was trying to swallow medications and breathing and blowing and staying calm and putting in different flavors. And the question was it going to be an orange flavor or a grape flavor? And the puppet had chosen an orange flavor. And then he had suggested at the end, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if this worked for Susie too? And I said, well, you know, that's going to be up to Susie and her mother. That's up to them. And I got this telephone call on my message machine saying, this is Susie's mother. Susie wanted to call Puppet and tell him that the grape flavor worked for her. And I said, I would call you and that you would tell the puppet.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a great
story. So it becomes
story.
Very, very real.
Indeed.
You know, but some children, you know, make having pictures of what they're going to be going through in terms of establishing a routine, using medical play so that they rehearse and they're not taken by surprise by a particular procedure.
Tell me about the experience of dealing with a child who is not going to survive. Is there a certain manner, is there a certain way to talk with that child if, say, that child is 5 or 6 or 15 or 16?
It's difficult to generalize, but I would say that it's always important to find out what the child themselves or the adolescent is thinking about what's happening. And it wouldn't usually be me anyway who would be breaking the news. It would be the doctors who would be reporting on treatment, success or lack of it.
But might you be with that doctor?
I might be.
Yes.
I might be.
Yes.
I do remember one experience where I was actually talking with a teenager, and I got a call from the doctor telling me that this particular teenager had relapsed, and that meant there would be no remaining curative treatment. And my expression obviously showed, because the young woman, who up to that point had not really wanted to talk anything about the likelihood that she could die, because at the moment people were hoping that she would not. But she said to me, "That was Dr. So-and-so, wasn't it?" Mm-hmm. And he said I'd relapsed. So I said, "I would. Is that something that you've been thinking about?" And she said yes, that she'd been talking about it with her boyfriend the night before, that she thought she had relapsed. And we then went on to talk about how very, very sad that was, but she certainly did have some time left, and what would she want to be spending that time? Were there certain things that she would want to do, where she would want to be? And we really sort of then began to map out how she wanted her remaining time to be spent. And then at the end of the time, because what she said to me was confidential, but she was able to say that it was all right if we shared what we had talked about with the medical team. And they were really able to respect and see that she was able to carry out many of her wishes.
Does a young child ever ask, what's it like to die?
A young child might be more like, am I going to die? And then, again, how come they're wondering that? And that question at the beginning of treatment is very different from that question asked down the road.
Of course.
When a child really has relapsed a couple of times and people are wondering what can be done, if anything. I mean, having wondering if any curative treatment remains. So a young child does have a wonderful imagination, and a young child is very able to have the conversation. You know, I remember a 7-year-old once saying, when the mother and I were meeting with the child, and because it was obvious that something was sort of bothering him, and we wondered what it might be. And I think this time I asked the question rather indirectly, was if a child is doing X, Y, and Z, which is what he was doing, what might he be worried about? And the child then was able to say, you know, he might be worried about dying, and he might be worried that he'd be alone when he died. Hmm. And we were then able to reassure him on those points, well, reassure him on the point that everybody would be sure that he would was the people would be with him, and that dying itself didn't hurt, but that the you know, and if there was anything that hurting on the way to dying, that he could be that there could be medicine that would allow him to feel comfortable,
which brings me to the situation we find ourselves in today, with these young children being separated from their parents in this immigrant situation. As a psychologist, as someone who has seen young children who are very fearful about being separated from their parents, What do you think the long-term effects of that kind of separation could be?
Occasionally, we would have childhood cancer survivors come into the survivors clinic who had been treated many, many years earlier. And I remember one person who told me that the story of what his treatment way back then was like. And in his situation, he'd been brought into the hospital and left by his parents, because parents in those days were not allowed to stay. And he thought that he'd been left there to die.
Mm.
And, you know, he was treated and he did get better. And, you know, they came back and got him maybe a month or so or several months later. And he never talked about it to his parents until after his father died and his mother had become ill herself. And they finally began to talk about the experience. And what he learnt was that they'd been told it was the only chance that this child would live. They hadn't wanted to leave him, but it was the only way that they could possibly save his life. And that what he'd noticed himself later in life was that he became completely terrified when a close family member was leaving. He thought they were not going to come back. He found himself panicked. So I think comparing the experience for children when their parents are able to stay with them in the hospital versus the time a few years ago when they were not, can give some indication of the difficulties for a child.
Mrs. Breyer, thank you so much for joining me on, certainly on my mind this week, so much about children. And your book, I think, will be a great help to parents, children, and doctors themselves.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was my first time speaking with Joanna Breyer, but I had her husband on the Diane Rehm Show a few times. He is, of course, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. I so enjoyed hearing his insights into how our democracy works and the role of the Supreme Court. Here's an excerpt from our conversation from 2010. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane.
Certainly.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question. You brought up Lincoln. Everybody, and I'm sure you are familiar with the speech he gave that began 67 years ago. And he ends that with the phrase, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Do you think we have that government?
Basically, I think so. That's what I know. There are lots of complaints about the political process. But if you look at the document, the Constitution, I think most of us today who work with it, I work with it, so we have some experience with it, will say the primary object of that document, the primary object, is to create institutions so that the people can decide democratically what kinds of cities, towns, and states and nation they want. And it's a special kind of democracy. It's a democracy that protects basic human rights, that assures a degree of equality, that divides power so no one becomes too powerful, three branches of federal government and federal and state governments, and it tries to guarantee a rule of law. But those basic elements are written into that document, and we on the court see those basic elements as boundaries, and those laws or actions which go beyond the boundaries are the actions that we, sometimes with great difficulty, decide are either inside the boundaries and permitted or outside and forbidden, and people focus on that, but they sometimes forget that we're at the boundaries, and that in between those boundaries is a vast, vast area where the public you and me as a citizen, because I can vote too, that we have to decide how to vote. And we have to decide what kind of city, town, state, and federal government we want. Now, that's hard work. It's hard work. It requires participation. It requires what you're doing, which is to think about the flaws in the system at present. And then you have to think, how are we going to cure them? And then you have to convince others. And the way we get something done is by thinking about it, learning about it, arguing about it, discussing it, maybe even sometimes not too civilly, though it should be civil, and trying to persuade others to come along. And it's Tocqueville said that. He said that in the 1830s. He said the first thing he notices in America is the clamor. Well, what's that? The clamor is everybody arguing, but out of all those little groups, cities meeting, town meetings, seminars in universities, newspaper articles, letters to the editors, congressional hearings.
But what about in the Supreme Court closed door?
I know that's something that bothers you. And it bothers you quite a lot. In the Supreme Court closed door, which will remain closed, is when we discuss our arguments.
Discuss or argue?
Discuss. I've never, never, never in 16 years heard a voice raised in anger in that room. I have never heard one justice say something deprecating or insulting of another. Those discussions are civil and professional, and always, always. And people have very different points of view. What good would it do to start shouting? The other person would just think he was right, and we don't do it.
You can hear that entire interview on our website, dianereem.org. One last note. I'll be gone for 3 weeks, but while I'm away, listen for some special podcasts in your feed. That's all for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Ben Privett. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reed.